Dependent arising has a profound implication. If one seeks, through extended analysis, the actual object to which the imputation is affixed, one does not come up with anything among or separate from its basis of imputation. Take the self or I as an example. The I is the controller or user of mind and body, and the mind and body are the objects of use. The I, body and mind, definitely do exist, and they perform their respective functions. The I is like an owner, and the body and mind belong to it. Indeed, we say, today there is something wrong with my body, therefore I am tired. Such statements are valid, but with respect to one's arm, for instance, nobody says, this is I. Still, when one's arm is painful, we do say, I am in pain. Despite this, it is clear that the I and the body are different. The body belongs to the I. Similarly, we speak of my mind as when we feel, my memory is so poor, something is wrong. We can even seem to oppose our own consciousness. Is it not so? We say such things as, I want to train my mind, in which case the mind is both the trainer and the object trained. When the mind is not doing what one wants it to, one is like the teacher, and the mind is like the unruly student. In this way, both body and mind are things that belong to the I, and the I is the owner. But aside from mind and body, there is no separate, independent entity of I. There is every indication that the I exists, yet under investigation it cannot be found. For example, the Dalai Lama's I must be located within the confines circumscribed by my body. There is no other place it could possibly be found. However, if one investigates within this area what the true Dalai Lama is, besides this body and mind, the I does not have its own substance. Still, the Dalai Lama is a fact, a man, a monk, a Tibetan, someone who can enjoy life. Is it not so? This is sufficient to prove that something exists, even though it cannot be found. This means that among the bases of imputation of the I, there is nothing to be found that is an illustration of the I or that is the I. Does this mean the I does not exist? No, it definitely does exist. But when it cannot be found among its bases of imputation that constitute the place where it must exist, one has to say that it is established not under its own power, but through the force of other conditions. It cannot be posited any other way. Among the conditions in dependence upon which the I exists, one of the more important factors is the conceptuality that designates it. Thus, it is said that the I and other phenomena exist through the power of conceptuality. In this way, dependent arising comes to mean not just arisen independence upon causes and conditions, or imputed independence upon a basis of imputation, but also arisen or imputed independence upon a conceptual consciousness that imputes the object. Thus, in the term dependent arising, dependent means depending or relying on other factors. Once the object depends on something else, it is devoid of being under its own power. Nevertheless, it does arise in reliance upon conditions. Good and bad, cause and effect, oneself and others, all objects are established in reliance upon other factors. They arise dependently. Due to being dependently arisen, objects are devoid of being under their own power. Also, because in this context of dependence help and harm arise, objects do not not exist. Their performance of functions is feasible. In this way, the causes and effects of actions are feasible, as is the I that is the basis of them. When one understands this, one is released from the extreme view of non-existence, nihilism. In this way, existing in dependence upon conceptuality is also a meaning of dependent arising, the most subtle meaning. Nowadays, physicists explain that phenomena do not exist merely objectively in and of themselves, but exist in the context of involvement with an observer. I feel that the relation between matter and consciousness is a place where Eastern philosophy and Western science could meet. I think this would be a happy marriage, with no divorce. If we work along the lines of a joint effort by Buddhist scholars with experience in meditation and unbiased physicists to engage in a deeper research in the relation between matter and consciousness, we may find beautiful things that may be helpful. Also, those scientists working on the human brain in the field of neurology could benefit from Buddhist explanations about consciousness. Some time ago, I asked a neurologist how memory functions. He reported that they still had not found a concrete explanation. So in this field, too, we could work together. Some Western medical professionals are also showing interest in curing certain illnesses through meditation. This is another interesting topic for a joint project. Because of Buddhism's emphasis on self-creation, there is no creator deity. Thus, some consider it, strictly speaking, not to be a religion. A Western Buddhist scholar told me, "Buddhism is not a religion. It is a kind of science of mind. In this sense, Buddhism does not belong to the category of religion." I consider this to be unfortunate, but in some sense it means that Buddhism becomes closer to science. However, from the scientist's viewpoint, Buddhism is a spiritual path. It is unfortunate that we do not seem to belong to science either. Buddhism thereby belongs to neither religion nor pure science, but this provides us with an opportunity to make a bridge between faith and science. This is why I believe that in the future we will have to work at bringing these two forces more closely together. The majority of people ignore religion, but among those who do not, there is on one side a group who are experiencing the value of a spiritual path, and on the other is a group who are denying any value to religion. As a result, there is constant conflict between these two factions. If, one way or another, we could help bring these two forces closer, it would be worthwhile. Question. Your Holiness, regarding consciousness, it was said that in the Middle Way school, as opposed to the mind-only school, the continual basis of a predisposition caused by an action is the mere I, while the temporary basis was said to be consciousness. Could you explain this further? Specifically, how can the everlasting basis of the predisposition be the mere I, which does not exist inherently or everlastingly? Also, how or what is the mechanism that stores the predisposition, and how does it travel from one lifetime to the next? Answer. When we speak of the nominally existent I that is a mere name, this does not mean that there is no meaning to I or self other than just the name. There is a meaning to which the name I refers. However, because the object I does not exist in a self-instituting way under its own power, but exists depending very much on the name, on conceptual imputation, it is said that it is name only, merely nominally imputed. Thus, in the term mere I, the word mere indicates that when the I is sought under analysis, it cannot be found. Not only is the I merely nominally imputed, but also predispositions themselves, as well as the actions that infuse the predispositions, are nominally imputed, as is everything else. That phenomena are merely nominal does not mean they do not exist at all. Rather, it means that within existing, they do not exist under their own power, by way of their own entity, by way of their own character. When it is said that the basis of infusion and of carrying the predispositions is name only, it might appear to your mind that then the basis of infusion really would not be much of anything. However, this is not the case. With regard to connecting a karma with its effect, consider this. In conventional vocabulary we say, "At an earlier time I did such and such," and it is a fact that the agent of that action is oneself. But if we look into the matter, the action has ceased, and the I of the present moment is not the I of the previous moment. Still, we say, "I did that," and this accords with the fact. One is, therefore, the owner of that action. In this way, there is a connection between the action and oneself. And this is what connects forward to the future effect of that action, no matter how much time passes. Since, for a person who performed an action and accumulated the karma, the continuum of the mere I keeps going, one continues to be the I who accumulated that karma. Since the action done earlier has to fructify, there is no one else for whom it can fructify except oneself. The I is designated in dependence upon the mental and physical aggregates, and in terms of the tantric or mantric system, there are coarse and subtle levels of those aggregates. From the viewpoint of highest yoga tantra, the final basis of imputation of the I has to be a subtle aggregate that has been together with oneself since beginningless time. This is a subtle level of consciousness, the continuum of which is beginningless and uninterrupted, eventually reaching fulfillment in Buddhahood. There is no question about whether afflicted minds go on to Buddhahood. Of course, they do not. Even coarser levels of consciousness do not. It is only the most subtle level of consciousness that proceeds to Buddhahood. This subtle level has lasted since beginningless time and continues forever. When we die, our coarser levels of consciousness dissolve. On our last day, at the time of our death, the final consciousness that manifests is this most subtle mind of clear light. It is this consciousness that makes the connection to the next lifetime. In this way, the subtler aggregates exist continuously throughout time. With regard to the way in which the I appears, there is a general type of I that has existed since beginningless time right through to the present. But with regard to particular I's, there is an I qualified, for instance, by one's own youth, and there is an I qualified by being related to a human lifetime, and so on. For instance, we refer to the I of our own youth. Oh, I used to be such a rascal when I was young. Many such distinctions are to be made within the I, some general and pervasive, and others more individual and less pervasive. Question: Is material energy the same as mental energy? Answer: In general, because matter and consciousness are different, it seems that the energy associated with them would be different. With respect to mental energy, there are many grosser and subtler levels of consciousness. The grosser level of consciousness is, the more it is related to the present body, whereas the subtler a consciousness is, the less connection it has with the gross physical body. Also, the subtler levels of mind are more powerful than the grosser levels. Thus, if one is able to utilize them, they are more effective for mental transformation. In order to discuss differences of energy, one has to consider many different levels of matter and consciousness. Question: How can we abandon innate ignorance? Answer: Certain types of ignorance can be removed with little exertion. But the type of ignorance that is the root of cyclic existence can only be removed with tremendous exertion. Indeed, the main topic of this series of lectures is how to bring about an end to ignorance. So far, I have been speaking about the foundation of one's practices. Next, I will discuss the levels of practice. Question: What is the most skillful way of dealing with anger and aggression without submitting to the aggressor or becoming angry oneself? Answer: If you keep letting anger out and expressing it, it is very difficult for this to be helpful. Since this behavior itself promotes more anger, it will not bring about any positive result. It will only increase problems. Under certain circumstances, it may be necessary to take a counteraction to stop another's wrongdoing. But without anger, the implementation of countermeasures is much more effective, because when your main mind is governed by a strong afflictive emotion, you may not take the appropriate action. Anger destroys judgment, the capacity to think this is wrong, and to investigate what the temporary and long-term consequences of an action will be. It is necessary to calculate such circumstances before taking action. Free of anger, the power of judgment is better. If, in a competitive society, you are sincere and honest, in some circumstances people may take advantage of you. If you let someone do so, he or she will be accumulating bad karma that will harm him or herself in the future. Thus, it is permissible, with an altruistic motivation, to take a counteraction to help the other person avoid the effects of this wrong action in the future. For instance, wise parents, without anger, may sometimes scold or even punish their children. But if the parent really gets angry and whacks the child too hard, then the parent will feel regret in the future. However, with the good motivation of seeking to correct a child's bad behavior, it is possible to respond in a way that is appropriate to what the child needs at that moment. Responses should be made in that way. According to the sutra system, use of anger is not permitted in the spiritual path. However, within the tantric system, it is possible to utilize anger in the path. The fundamental motivation must be compassion, but the temporary motivation is anger, and the purpose is to utilize the strength of anger without coming under its negative influence, so that practice becomes more effective. Question: is it better to leave hatred alone as a potential within oneself, or to actualize it and thereby face it? Answer: there is a practice in which to identify hatred, how the hated object appears, how one's mind reacts, what the nature of hatred is, and so forth. One allows the mind to generate hatred and then watches it. But this is not a case of displaying hatred externally and fighting with another person. If there is a danger of your going outside with an angry attitude, it is better to lock your door with you inside, then generate anger and examine it. For certain types of mental problems, such as depression, it can be helpful to let them out by talking about them. This reduces the uncomfortable inner feeling. For other kinds of mental crises, such as anger or strong attachment, the more you express them, the more they will occur. With these types, restraint will cause them to weaken. However, restraint does not just mean that when you develop anger or attachment to a high degree, you attempt at that moment to control it, for that is very difficult. Rather, in a daily practice, you should continuously reflect on the advantages of compassion, love, and kindness, and on the disadvantages of anger. Such continuous contemplation creates dislike for hatred and respect for love. Through the force of this, even when you become angry, the expression changes in aspect and diminishes in force. This is the way to practice. As time passes, mental attitudes can gradually change. Question: how is it possible for me to make an effort in my meditation practice when there is no me, no I? Answer: most likely, this is the misunderstanding I mentioned earlier, wrongly interpreting the emptiness of inherent existence as an emptiness of existence itself, such that it seems that nothing exists. This is wrong. If you think you do not exist, stick a pin in your finger. Even if you cannot identify the I, that it exists is clear. Question: I have received many initiations from my guru, but now I have lost some faith in him. What shall I do? Answer: this is a sign of your not having been careful at the beginning. If faith alone were sufficient, there would have been no reason for the Buddha to have set forth the qualifications of a guru in great detail. It is said to be very important for both the guru and the student to investigate each other. Still, this situation about which you are speaking does occur. I usually tell people that at the beginning it is not necessary to regard the teacher as one's guru. Rather, simply consider the teacher to be a religious friend from whom you are receiving teachings. Then if, as time passes, you examine the person's qualifications and gain real conviction, you can regard him or her as your guru. Now, to address your question about what to do, if the situation is that you first had faith and now you cannot generate faith, rather than coming to dislike the person, it would be better to develop a neutral attitude. Another helpful technique is to reflect on the fact that in Buddhism, even our enemy is considered to be one of the best gurus. Even though an enemy may deliberately harm you, it is a basic practice to develop deep respect and gratitude toward that person. If that is the case, then it is even more so here, since your guru is most likely not deliberately harming you. It can help your mental attitude to look at the situation this way. Question. What is your opinion about Western students of Buddhism doing the practice of protector deities? Answer. This is a complicated matter. What one does individually is one's own business. However, it is important to understand the context of such a practice. The theory of protector deities comes from tantric practice. In the sutra systems, aside from the occasional mention of the four great royal kings, there is no mention of deities other than the likes of Manjushri, Avalokiteshvara, Tara, Maitreya, and Samantabhadra. In Maitreya's Ornament for Clear Realization, at the point of the serial training in the six mindfulnesses, there is a practice of mindfulness of gods or deities. And it might be possible that these latter deities, as well as the great four kings, appear within this practice. However, the context there is of being mindful of them as witnesses of your own actions. On the other hand, many tantric texts mention protector deities. In the tantric systems, a practitioner of a protector deity first must gain initiation and then attain a deep state of meditation in which visualization practices of deity yoga eventually make one qualified to conduct this practice. While imagining oneself as a deity in a mandala, one visualizes a protector deity in front of oneself and gives him or her an order that has a use in a particular field of action. Hence, if you want to engage in the practice of a protector deity, you yourself must first be qualified. In the past in Tibet, many people did the opposite, completely neglecting their own practice and simply running after protector deities. This is absolutely wrong. One is supposed to achieve a clear appearance of oneself as a divine figure within a full sense of being that deity, whereupon the protector comes under one's control. The practice is not at all a matter of the protector controlling oneself. In fact, the best protector is Buddha, his doctrine, and the spiritual community. In a deeper sense, the actual protector and the actual destroyer are your own karma. If you ask what really helps, it is your own virtuous actions. If you ask what really harms, it is your own non-virtuous action. This is important. Question. Must desire always lead to attachment? Answer. In Tibetan, there is a clear distinction between dupa and duchak. The first means wishing or wanting, which can be reasonable or not, whereas the second is an afflictive emotion. Reason desire exists even in a foe destroyer, someone who has gone beyond cyclic existence. Despite this verbal difference, during the initial stages of practice when one is still a common being, it is difficult to distinguish between mere desire and afflictive desire. And one could even have faith that is mixed with the conception of inherent existence, or compassion that is mixed with the conception of inherent existence, in which oneself and the object of faith, or of compassion, are wrongly thought to be established by way of their own character. It is difficult to distinguish between these at the beginning, but through practice, one can gradually identify the factors of ignorance and the afflictive emotions, thereby making practice more and more pure. Lecture 3. Levels of the Path. The 12 links of dependent arising of a lifetime in cyclic existence represent our basic situation: afflictive emotions, contaminated actions, and suffering. Can the mind be separated from such ignorance or not? This needs to be examined. Any type of consciousness is subject to conditioning with familiarization. Still, no matter how much a mistaken consciousness increases in strength due to habituation, it cannot be increased limitlessly, since it does not have a valid foundation. On the other hand, a consciousness with a valid foundation can always be strengthened through conditioning, and eventually can become limitless. It is said that mental qualities have a stable basis, since consciousness on which they are founded has no beginning and no end. So long as one keeps practicing, one's mental qualities do not require the exertion involved in first acquiring them. Hence, their strength can gradually be increased. Since the root of suffering is ignorance, suffering stems from an untamed mind. Correspondingly, Since relief from suffering comes from purifying and destroying the ignorance in the mind, it stems from taming the mind. Not taming the mind leads to suffering, whereas taming the mind leads to happiness. The mind is tamed by mental training. Since the trainer is a particular type of mind, and since that which is being trained is also the mind, one has to become skilled in psychology. Thus, in Buddhist texts, a great deal of attention is devoted to the discussion of consciousness. The most untamed type of mind, the grossest level of mind that apprehends its object erroneously, is called wrong knowledge. As the mind becomes accustomed to the teachings, it is transformed into the level of doubt. Within doubt, there are three levels. The lowest is doubt that tends towards what is wrong. The middle is equal doubt that tends toward both what is wrong and what is right. And the highest level is doubt that tends towards what is right. Through practice, doubt is gradually transformed into a level called correctly assuming consciousness, which, through continued training methods such as reflecting on reasons, turns into inference. Becoming accustomed to inferential understanding and developing an increasingly clear appearance of the object being understood, one attains direct perception of that object. To overcome wrong views, one needs to reflect on the absurd consequences of such views. For this reason, Buddhist texts on logic present many forms of absurd consequences. At the level of doubt, it is possible to make use of syllogistic reasonings aimed at inferential understanding. This is why it is important to study the books of the two pillars of logic, Dignaga and Dharmakirti, to develop the wisdom of differentiating phenomena. In the process, a practitioner gradually generates the wisdom arisen from hearing, from thinking, and finally the wisdom arisen from meditation. With this type of practice, one gradually comes to see that it is indeed possible to transform consciousness. From this perspective, one can develop conviction in the efficacy of nonviolence. The first level in this practice is to restrain oneself from engaging in activities that harm others. The second is to implement antidotes to afflictive emotions that drive bad actions. And the third is to overcome even the predispositions previously established by afflictive emotions. To remove latent predispositions, it is necessary first to extinguish the afflictive emotions, for without this, there is no possibility of extricating the predispositions they establish in the mind. The state of having entirely removed the afflictive emotions as well as their predispositions is called Buddhahood, whereas the mere removal of the afflictive emotions is the stage of an arhat, a foe-destroyer. The destruction of the afflictive emotions and the predispositions established by them is much like an offensive engagement. Thus, it is important to first engage in a defensive line of action, making sure that one will not come under the influence of these counterproductive emotions. This is why it is important initially to restrain ill deeds of body and speech. The final aim is the attainment of Buddhahood, but initially, one must prevent coming under the influence of ill deeds. When one acts with a selfish motive and commits wrong actions, such as killing, stealing, adultery, lying, divisive talk, harsh speech, and senseless chatter, one not only harms others, but ultimately brings suffering on oneself in terms of the cause and effects of actions. By thinking along these lines, one can see that it is necessary to restrain ill deeds of body and speech, and develops the conviction that harming others brings loss to oneself. This is to be reflected upon again and again. It also is helpful to reflect on impermanence. No matter how long our life is, there is a limit to it, is there not? When we think about the formation of this universe, the lifetime of a human is very short, and there is no guarantee that we can live out even a normal human lifespan. Under these circumstances, it is senseless to concentrate all one's energy on accumulating money and property. Since it is clear that wealth is helpful only for this life, it is appropriate to reduce extreme greed. At this level of the teaching, there is no reference to love and compassion for other people. Rather, emphasis is on realizing that the ill deeds are detrimental, even from the point of view of one's own welfare. Also, it is clear from the current world situation that no amount of material progress can fulfill what beings are seeking. Material progress does solve certain problems, but through our own experience we know that material progress is not sufficient on its own. At this stage, it is helpful to reflect on the usefulness of having gained the state of a human being. Considering how the human body can be utilized in a positive way, one understands that it is sad to use it for a harmful purpose. Also, for some people, it is helpful to reflect on the sufferings of the three bad levels of transmigration: hell beings, hungry ghosts, and animals. If it is difficult to believe that there are hell beings, consider the many sufferings animals undergo. Now we should imagine ourselves living as one of them. We should consider whether we could bear it or not. When we think in this way, we develop a sense of not wanting to be reborn as an animal. What brings about these results are acts of harmfulness and violence against others. That is the first level of reflection on the faults of violence and the need to restrain ill deeds of body and speech. Still, there is no guarantee that even if one restrains such activities this lifetime, one will not come under their influence in the next. Therefore, the best defense is to practice the next level of nonviolence, called active engagement. The afflictive emotions that bring about all this trouble for us are those mentioned in the 12 links of dependent arising. Their root is the ignorance that conceives objects as inherently existing. The force of this ignorance induces desire and hatred, as well as many other types of afflictive emotions such as pride, doubt, enmity, jealousy, and so forth. These are real troublemakers. When we analyze the problems of our present world, whether on the international level or in the family, it is clear that they are related to our anger, jealousy, and attachment. Let us consider our so-called enemy, whom we hate. Due to the fact that this person's mind is untamed, he or she engages in activities to bring injury to us. And because of this, we consider that person an enemy. If the wish to harm were in the very nature of the person, it could not be altered. But it is not the case that hatred resides in the nature of that person. Rather, just like ourselves, the person displays bad behavior due to having generated an afflictive emotion. We ourselves engage in bad behavior, do we not? Still, we do not always think we are completely bad. The situation is the same with this other person, whom we consider to be an enemy. Consequently, the actual troublemaker is not the person, but his or her afflictive emotion. The real enemy is an internal factor. As practitioners, our real battle should take place within ourselves. It will take time, but this is the only way to minimize counterproductive human qualities. Through such practice, we will attain more mental peace. To create peace of mind, the question of whether the afflictive emotions can be overcome is crucial. At this point, one is training to overcome the afflictive emotions. And to do this, it is necessary to destroy their root, which is the ignorance that conceives inherent existence. To do this, it is necessary to generate a reasoning consciousness that perceives objects in exactly the opposite way to how we would perceive them with ignorance. Only such a consciousness can serve as an antidote to afflictive emotions. Ignorance conceives phenomena to exist in and of themselves, whereas in fact objects do not exist this way. To overcome this ignorance, it is necessary to refute with reasoning its conceived object, inherent existence. We must realize that objects do not exist inherently in and of themselves. In order to develop a realization of emptiness capable of removing this ignorance, one cannot merely generate a reasoned inferential consciousness that realizes emptiness. In addition, one must directly perceive the emptiness. To accomplish this, deep concentration is necessary, with which it is possible to develop samadhi, or meditative stabilization, a union of calm abiding and special insight. Thus, it is said that to generate the wisdom consciousness constituted by special insight into emptiness, it is necessary first to generate a calm abiding of the mind the tranquilization and focusing of consciousness. It is advantageous to develop the mind's ability to remain on its object of observation, and by developing vivid one-pointedness, the mind gradually becomes more alert and more able. Someone who wants to achieve mental calm abiding cannot live as we do now, but should stay in an isolated place, where continual practice can be cultivated over a long time. In addition, if one works at achieving calm abiding in connection with tantric practices, it is said to be easier. Still, for those not ready for such intense practice, it is helpful to rise early in the morning and immediately use the mind while it is still clear to investigate the nature of mind itself without thinking about other topics. This helps keep the mind alert, thereby helping one throughout the rest of the day. To reach the point where even subtle internal distractions have been pacified and the mind remains continuously on its object of observation, one must first restrain grosser distractions, the coarse ill deeds of body and speech that scatter the mind to objects of desire and hatred. For this, one needs training in ethics. The Buddhist system of ethics contains two levels, one for householders or laypersons, and one for those who have left the householder life. Even within the level of layperson's ethics, there are several stages. So many variations occur because the Buddha set forth levels of practice in accordance with the varying capacities of individuals. It is crucial to follow a path according to one's own mental disposition. Only then will one gain satisfactory results. Recognizing this is helpful, not only in gaining a proper perspective on Buddhist teachings, but also in developing respect for different types of religious systems, since they are all beneficial to those who believe in them. Though the differences in philosophy are tremendous, still one can see that those philosophies are beneficial in the conduct of people's lives, relative to their interests and dispositions. Through understanding this, deep respect will be engendered. Today, we need this kind of mutual respect and understanding. Quite a number of Western men and women have become monks and nuns. I respect their decision, but there should be no rush to take vows. Since the Buddha set forth practices in accordance with various levels of capacity, it is critical to determine what one's own level is, and gradually to advance within that. It is important that Westerners who want to practice Buddhism remain in their own communities without becoming isolated. It is important to adopt the essence of the Buddha's teaching, recognizing that Buddhism, as it is practiced by Tibetans, is influenced by Tibetan culture. It would be a mistake for Westerners to try to practice a Tibetanized form of Buddhism, since such a system does not fit with their own minds and makes interaction with society difficult. Nowadays, some people act like Tibetans, even to the point of keeping their heads down in an abject manner. Instead of copying such cultural forms, one should remain within one's own cultural forms and implement the Buddha's teaching if something useful can be found in it. One should work in his or her profession as a member of the community. Although the centers that are already established are useful, it is not necessary for someone who wants to practice Buddhism even to join a particular center. We have now discussed the first two levels of practice, of fighting against afflictive emotions. Next, we will consider the third level, how to develop compassion in order to destroy the predispositions established by afflictive emotions, the obstructions to omniscience. Initially, one trains in ethics, which forms the basis of all later practice. Then, through the practice of meditative stabilization, the mind becomes powerfully focused and effective in meditating on emptiness. Eventually, one overcomes the predispositions. First, intellectually acquired obstructions are overcome. Then gradually, the innate obstructions are removed. Within innate obstructions, there are many levels of afflictive emotions to be overcome. But finally, one completely extricates the ignorance that is the root of all afflictive emotions, the conception of inherent existence. This ignorance and all the afflictive emotions induced by it are extinguished or pacified in the sphere of reality. The wisdom that realizes emptiness directly, undermines the ignorance that conceives inherent existence, and the extinguishing of that ignorance is called liberation. As the protector Nagarjuna says in his treatise on the middle, when actions and afflictive emotions cease, there is liberation. Actions and afflictive emotions arise from false conceptions, which in turn arise from fictive elaborations. Fictive elaborations cease in emptiness. Unquote. Contaminated actions and afflictive emotions are produced from wrong conceptuality, which is produced from elaborations of the conception of inherent existence. Those conceptual elaborations are ceased through emptiness, or are ceased in emptiness. The former means that conceptual elaborations are ceased through cultivating the view that realizes emptiness. Because they are extinguished in the reality of emptiness itself, here emptiness is also interpreted as that into which the fictive elaborations cease. That reality is the true cessation of the sources of suffering, liberation. Question. I have heard that becoming drowsy during meditation on the breath may indicate that this is not a suitable practice, and that one should seek an alternative method. Could you comment on this? Answer. It often happens that when people meditate, they become drowsy. Therefore, for some people with insomnia, I even advise them to recite mantra. During meditation, the mind can come under the influence of lethargy, a heaviness that leads to drowsiness and even sleep. This is due to the fact that the mode of apprehension of the mind has become too loose. A counteractive technique is to make the mind more taut, whereby it is revitalized. If this does not work, then one should imagine something bright or pay attention to details of the object being meditated upon, since lethargy is caused by the mind's being withdrawn too much inside. If this does not work, one can leave the session and look far into the distance, perhaps at a panoramic view, or wash one's face, or go out into the fresh air. If you become sleepy when concentrating on the breath but do not experience this when concentrating on some other object, it might be suitable to switch your object. It might help to meditate on a certain element, or a certain type of light at a particular channel center, or while contemplating the breath, to meditate on light in the upper part of the body. In general, when the mind sinks and becomes lax, it is helpful to move the object upward, and when the mind becomes excited, it helps to move the object downward. The remedy has to be geared to the meditator's situation. Question. What advice do you have for the parents of a 7-year-old child who has brain cancer? Answer. No doubt the parents will use every means to bring about a cure medically. In addition, there are cases where it is helpful to employ meditative techniques such as repeating mantras and using certain visualizations. But whether these could be effective right away depends on many factors. In the Buddhist system, when other methods have not been effective, it is beneficial to reflect on the cause and effect of actions, karma. Those who believe in a creator can think of such difficulties as activities of God and gain comfort from this way of seeing things. The most important factor is that the child must remain mentally peaceful. Besides these points, it is difficult to make suggestions. It is said that when the effect of an action is in the stage of manifest fruition, it is difficult to reverse it. Question. We are told that progress along the spiritual path depends upon faith. What is the substantial cause of faith? Answer. In general, faith is of three types. The faith of clear delight, the faith of wishing to achieve a beneficial quality, and the faith of conviction. Concerning the main causes of faith, it is helpful to reflect on reasons that promote conviction and to develop actual experience yourself, whereby faith becomes more firm. Within faith and other types of spiritual experience, there are basically two types. One that comes by adventitious causes, suddenly sweeping over one, and another that comes by exerting effort over a long time. The latter is more stable, but adventitious experiences are beneficial. It is helpful when you have an unusual and profound experience to take hold of it and sustain it with effort at that time. question. I find it difficult to comprehend all the different levels of practice. What is a simple basic practice that I could bear in mind? Answer. At best, if you are able to do so, help others. If you are not able to do so, at least do not harm others. This is the main practice. In terms of the stages of practice, on the first level one restrains ill deeds by avoiding the 10 non-virtues, then takes vows relative to that level. Later, one performs more altruistic practices and takes vows related to this vaster level. Question. Is it possible to reconcile special love for one person, as in marriage, with equanimity? Or is it only possible to develop equanimity if one is completely non-attached, with no personal involvements? Answer. During the initial stages of practice, one has different levels of love, stronger for those who are, for the time being, closer to oneself, and weaker for those who are not. However, as one practices, one's love becomes equal toward every being. Such all-pervasive love, however, cannot come right away. In the initial stages of practice, love, compassion, faith, and so forth are mostly mixed with at least a little of the afflictive emotions. Question. Many Buddhists find it disturbing to hear of Buddhist teachers who break certain precepts by, for example, saying that it is permissible to drink alcohol, to cohabit with members of the spiritual community, and so forth. Are there ever any circumstances under which these precepts may be broken? Answer. It is said in the scriptures of the Bodhisattva vehicle that for the maturation of one's own mental continuum, there is the practice of the six perfections, giving, ethics, patience, effort, concentration, and wisdom. And for the maturation of others, there are the four means of gathering students, giving material things to students, speaking pleasantly, which means to teach how to gain better lifetimes and eventually leave cyclic existence, causing students to practice what is helpful and to discard what is counterproductive, and practicing what one teaches others. When what a person teaches and practices are contradictory, he or she does not have the full qualifications of a spiritual guide. In the Tantra system, there is a procedure for great adepts who are at a very high level of realization to behave in unusual ways. The boundary line for engaging in these activities is said to be when the adept has attained capacity. This means the yogi has reached the point whereby, through the power of yoga, he or she is capable of overcoming the non-faith that would be caused in others by the display of these activities. For instance, the great Pandita, Talopa, despite displaying many unusual modes of behavior to Naropa, was fully capable of overcoming his non-faith. Thus, unusual deeds may be done only after having attained such capacity. On the other hand, if a lama who does not have such a capacity still tries to legitimate his or her irregular behavior, this just indicates that his or her back is to the wall. Question. Would you explain the connection between an action completed many lifetimes ago and its karmic result as experienced through a natural disaster, such as being struck by lightning? Is it that our present consciousness affects or creates the lightning? Answer. With respect to karma, it is relatively easy to understand that in general a virtuous action will lead to a pleasurable effect because of a similarity of nature between cause and effect. However, when one considers a specific action at a specific time that creates a specific effect at a specific time, these factors are subtle and difficult to understand. With regard to the example of being hit by lightning, as I mentioned earlier, there are four procedures for investigating objects. One is to examine the nature of an object that is just naturally so, as burning is the very nature of fire, and moistening is the very nature of water. Similarly, lightning is produced through the machinations of the elements of this world system itself. But the fact that one was at that spot where the lightning hit is indeed due to karma.